Welcome back to Biff, a podcast about superhero TV shows, movies, and Egyptology. My name is Dan Morin, and I am joined, as always, by my compatriots. John Moltz is here. Hi, John.
Hi. I was going to bring cupcakes, but the van, something happened to the van, so they never arrived. Sorry.
Sure. Likely story.
Mm-hmm.
Guy English is also here. Hi, Guy.
I'm calling in this week from Lundon?
I don't know why you're saying it like that.
They're literally talking English to him. Like, that is such a dick move. It's like, I'm clearly in a foreign country. Maybe I'll just butcher the word and you'll understand it. Like, oh, God.
There's a lot of questions. We are here to discuss the latest MCU streaming series, Moon Knight, which is airing now on Disney Plus. And we're going to be discussing today episode one of Moon Knight, entitled, and I realized, of course, as I said that I didn't have the title in front of me, which I meant to tell you the title.
Goldfish,
the Goldfish Problem?
I
believe
it's
so. The Goldfish Problem.
Yeah.
And
do you get it on account of his goldfish?
Yeah.
His memory?
Someone replaced his goldfish.
Put this together. Yep. I'm picking up what they're putting down. I'm going to do the recap, which I realized I have not done a recap in a super long time, guys. I'm sorry about that. It's been like, I looked at I opened my Biff folder in notes, which is where I keep all my recap notes when I make them. And my last one was from November. So
what was that? Stargirl?
Stargirl. Yeah. It's been a little time, but I'm back in the saddle. So let's kick it off with what I think might be the first canonical appearance of Bob Dylan in the Marvel Cinematic Universe opening this episode.
Yeah, a piper for Bob Dylan, just to add to his paucity of awards that he's gained over his whole life.
Yeah.
So, yeah, because he was in Watchmen.
I know. I was making a joke about pipes being a musical instrument, harmonica being a musical. I don't know.
And the name of the song is something about sand, grain of sand.
It's Every Grain of Sand, which...
Every Grain of Sand, that's it, yeah.
As
shall we start over? No, this is the chaos. This show is about chaos, not our show and this show.
Yeah, there's chaos within us. It's chaos. All
yeah, just
down.
Don't look behind you, Dan, because
I try.
Bob Dylan's got like a skull mask on behind you.
So we briefly meet, although we don't think we know immediately it's him, Arthur Harrow, who is taking a little sip of water and then breaking a glass and stuffing it in his shoes, as one does, noted footwear enthusiast. We don't know where he is. Looks like it could be a castle, could be someplace else. Unclear. As we get the Marvel splash screen with another pop song over it, we meet Stephen Grant, who wakes up tied to his bed with sand around it and tape on his door.
Not in a good way.
We've all been there.
Every Saturday.
We learn a lot about Stephen in these opening scenes. He seems to have trouble sleeping as he falls asleep on the bus. He knows a lot about Egypt, as he tells a kid who is at the museum where he works about the Egyptians removing organs from their mummies. He works in the gift shop. Where he seems, you know, in general to be kind of a sad sack, I think would probably be the best way to put it.
Yeah.
And so we are probably as surprised as Stephen is when a woman comes up and asks if they're still on for their date in the following night.
He's got some real Ugly Betty energy going on. Like,
yeah, because like, he's Oscar Isaac.
He's Oscar Isaac.
You're supposed to think he's just
even as he is acting as bumbling as he is, I was like, yeah, well, no kidding. She wanted to go out for dinner with him. Like, I did not think anything was amiss other than that she was going to be an interesting character who somehow saw beyond how screwed up this guy was. Turns out not the case. Well, we assume
We learn a lot about him in these scenes. Also, he's a vegan. He is constantly late. He kind of harbors designs of being a tour guide. I really laughed a lot, especially on my rewatch, where his boss tells him, like, if you're auditioning to be a tour guide again, like, I've told you. And then he pauses in the middle of what he's saying to say, that's actually crushing to hear. He's very disappointed.
I want to gush all over from this entire episode. It is great. Like, those little asides, he does one later to the lady he wants to exchange this fish with, which I'll get to. But those little small asides really make his character something that you can sort of enjoy without it being pure bumbling. Like, there's still a sense of, like, there, you know, like, he's not just an idiot.
He's a person with aspirations and dreams and goals.
Exactly.
But he's also funny. I mean, he's, you know, like, he seems to be like trying to make the best of his sad sack life, right?
And yeah.
He's making right. jokes and, like, you know, trying to be... He's amusing himself because he doesn't seem to have any friends or right. any relationships.
Right.
And so
I love his joke about, like, the ankle bracelet being a red flag.
Yeah.
You think that's going to hurt your dating life?
Yeah, he's self-aware, yeah. right? I mean, so in the following scene, he vents to his only friend, which is a living statue, I guess. And talks about not being able to sleep very much and all those problems.
Who is apparently a character.
Yeah, the name is a character from the Pantheon.
Crowley. Okay. I think it's...
Yeah, like...
Yeah, some streetwise person who, like, when he's in New York in the comic books, helps him navigate New York, I believe.
Yeah, like a Frenchie style. We haven't even covered Frenchie, so anybody coming into the show is going to be confused. But basically, like Batman, he's got a series of sort of informants, and this is the name of this character, living statue character, is a name given to one of his informants in New York, I guess. Yeah.
Right. So we also learn that he is trying to stay awake every night by doing things like puzzles and reading books, which seem to be mostly researching Egypt. And it seems like it's maybe going okay until he wakes up in a field with his jaw dislocated in the middle of the Alps. At which point a loud voice that it doesn't seem to belong to anybody tells him to surrender the body. He discovers that he's outside a castle where some guys are leaning out the window and then starts shooting at him with guns. So he runs away.
I love that he waves to them.
Well, that was that's natural. I love that the guy waves back. That's the key, right?
I know.
The guy's just very perplexed.
The guy's like, what are you doing?
I kind of love that. Like, that's an involuntary sort of human thing, right? Like,
somebody waves, you wave back.
Hey, how's it going?
He flees and hides in the nearby town, and we see the entrance of our friend from the opening, Arthur Harrow, who clearly has a cult-like following as everybody sort of reaches out to touch him, and he's got this whole, like, sort of Jesus aura going on. We see his performance in front of them as he judges people's souls with his cane and a funky tattoo on his wrist, referring to the goddess Amit, who appears to be an Egyptian deity. One person he like gives the thumbs up, like, you're a good person, and then a woman who is judged apparently is not good enough and basically gets killed and has the life force sucked out of them. One of his flunkies shows up to say there was a problem with the exchange and they are tracking down the person, and he identifies our friend Steven and asks him to return the scarab that he earlier found in his jacket when he woke up in the field.
And the way that he identifies him, too, is very clever.
He makes everybody else kneel.
Basically, it's everybody to kneel, and they all know the command to kneel, and he doesn't. And so
there's so much going on.
And he's like, oh, shit.
We're learning so much from this scene, right? Because those villagers are not listening to him like he's some crazy person on the street. They are invested. Old woman who dies is... knows what the outcome, well, she doesn't know what the outcome is going to be, but she knows the possible
outcomes. Yeah.
Yeah. They have no problem with a bunch of guys running around with machine guns, just chilling out.
Yeah.
I wondered about that
the first time around, but it clearly, like you said, everybody here seems to be bought in. Like there's a point later on when they're trying to get the scarab away from him, where like a person runs out of a shop and starts grabbing at him. And you're like, what is going on in this town?
Yeah.
In this moment, what happens is Harrow asks him to return the scarab. He, pulls it out and tries to give it over when the voice says, you will give him nothing. And all of a sudden, he doesn't seem to be in control of his body. He keeps, snatching it away from the guy, even as he's protesting that he's not trying to do it. And at one point, they all jump on him and try to pry the scarab away. And he has essentially what seems to be, a blackout, and then wakes up in the middle of a bunch of incapacitated, really bloody people.
Yeah. And I like the way they do that too, like that sort of skipping.
Yes, yeah,
that stutter step, and then it's just done. You know, like they don't have anything other than you basically see it from his perspective,
right?
Yeah, it doesn't turn into bullet time, and he just destroys everybody.
Right, everybody's staring at him too to be like, oh wow, that guy just wrecked.
Yeah, and the woman with a kid. Yeah, it must have happened real quick because that woman is still standing there with her kid.
Yeah,
yeah.
So that.
Which means, I mean, I don't know how long it's going to take to beat up five guys when you're Moon Knight, but he seems to have done it in real quick order if there's still civilians standing around, gawking at it.
Right, right. The crowd chases after him, and he steals the only available vehicle, which is a cupcake van. And what ensues is a really kind of great car chase to wake me up before you go, which includes a lot of fantastic bits like the going past the car, the truck full of chickens where the old lady gives him the finger.
How classic is a winding road with just a truck full of chickens?
Yeah, my wife watching this was like, I think James Bond has driven down this road.
Oh, so, yeah,
at least once.
Oh, it's
maybe
such
twice.
A trope, and it's so wonderful every time.
But I enjoy every bit here. We kind of have these intercuts where he does continually black out and then wake up again. And like, you know, one time there's a guy who's in the truck and he's like smushing a cupcake into his face, and then he blacks out, wakes up, and he's holding the guy's gun, and the guy is like
and
dead
the
in the back of the truck.
Falls out of the back of the truck, yeah.
The my absolute possible favorite scene in the entire episode is when he wakes up at one point going backwards in the truck, and then at one point throws the gun out of the front window of the truck.
Yeah, and of course the voice is commenting,
like,
you know,
he just
providing live commentary. Yeah.
This is where I started to really enjoy. I mean, I'd been enjoying it so far, but I'm like, okay, we're going for some laughs here because F. Murray Abraham, getting really mad, like as a god, being mad, like, oh, the idiot threw the gun away. Like, he's just so exasperated by the stupidity of an everyday human being. It's just, it's funny. It's just a funny setup for, you know,
and I mean, not
gun.
And certainly brutal as this ends with like logs rolling down the cliff and smashing people to death. As he then wakes up back in his apartment where all of his precautions seem to still be in place and he's convinced it's a dream, except one thing's weird. Gus, his goldfishy friend, had one fin when he went to bed and now has two fins. So he goes to the store where he bought the fish and is demanding there's a problem with the fish. And the woman says something cryptic about, like, I told you yesterday, they've all got two fins. at which point he is still confused and then notices the time and realizes he'll be late for his date.
I love how he snaps at her here. And then she like just gives a little sort of reaction in her face. And he just says, sorry. And then he sort of changes his demeanor a little. Like, his exasperation is at his circumstance, not particularly at the person. And when he realizes he's gotten a little, he's kind of just yelled at her for no good reason. He steps it back a bit, and it's just such a great little piece of acting that, like, really hard to pull off. Somebody in this kind of weird mental state, in the conditions we've just seen, managing that little bit of humanity to sort of back off, just somebody who sold him a fish, and he's just confused about what the circumstances are. Anyway, just great. I've been loved. He's so great. He's funny and just, he can pull it off, and it's
really, but you're enjoyable. Right. You're right about the balance, which I think is really interesting. It's that weird combination of it's funny, and yet it's also like brutal and serious at the
harrowing,
same time. It's not a comedy.
Yeah, right.
But it's definitely funny and kind of.
I don't even know if it's
wacky.
A dark comedy. It's
It's not dark like Peacemaker or something
that,
because you take it more seriously.
The humor is not necessarily at the expense of, I don't know, I feel like in a dark comedy there's a lot more laughing at sort of the brutality of it, and that's the parts that are funny are less that than his dealing with his being at sea in what's happening,
right? And they specifically go out of their way to elide the combat, basically. Like, we don't get to see whoever it's going to be, Mark Spector or Moon Knight or blah, 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 beating the crap out of these people. We're along with the idiot, and we are new to the show and new to the story as idiots. Like, we are as lost in this world as he is, and that's a great way to do the character. And the way he manages to pull it off mirrors our own sort of, like, this whole thing is weird.
Yeah.
While still being kind of funny, because in the way that you sort of laugh at uncomfortable situations a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, just I'm loving it. For whatever reason, I love that fish scene, which is I don't know why that's one of my favorite scenes, but I loved it.
He's also in like a blender or something.
Yeah. Fish is in a blender. That's right. Which seems like
that
a bad
seems
idea.
Bad. I mean, I get it. Yeah. That's the only thing you had, but still,
I love the MacGyverism of that, though. Right? Like, like he saw a fish that regrew a fin from his perspective. He thinks it's still Friday.
Right. Well, so that's what we're getting at. Like, so what we learn is when he goes to the restaurant to have his date, he thinks he's being stood up and calls her only to discover that it's Sunday, not Friday, and he missed their date and he stood her up. In regret, he orders us.
Because he was in Europe.
Yep, he orders himself a steak, which is
an
uncomfortable scene, as you know, pointed out. Like, he's a vegan, and like,
yeah,
it's like, you know, falling off the wagon, like, basically.
Screw it.
And he also orders a super expensive steak cooked really badly.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but
right.
He doesn't know. Well, he doesn't know. Like, they're like, what part of the steak do you want? He's like,
the best
bit?
Part. Yeah.
The best part. Yeah. The
best part. And then how do you like it? He's like,
get a filet well done.
Well, I like that he doesn't say
well done. No, he's like, how do you like it? Because I like it good.
Because, like, in the same way that somebody might ask you, like, how did you find your meal? And you're like, oh, yes, it was very good. Right. It was very good. And he's like, oh, well, how did you like it? Oh, yeah, I like steak. It's very good.
But the waiter says he's going to get it for him well done. Yeah. And it's like,
well, the waiter's trying to go,
oh, God, no, please don't do that.
Yeah, the waiter's trying to accommodate. Whatever, story for another time, but being at restaurants where the waiter was just like, no, we're not going to do that to your steak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Right.
On the way home, we also get the second time he calls his mom, apparently leaving a message as he did earlier in the episode. I think an interesting mystery as to who exactly he is calling.
Right.
Back at the apartment, he eats all of the chocolates by himself. Again, a great sad sack scene where he's got the like flecks of chocolate on his mouth, and he gives a little to the fish, even though he's realized, you know, like, this fish is not my fish.
I cannot get through your recap without commenting on this. Did fish get killed by chocolate? Like,
I don't know, but you should not. He said he was giving them the sprinkles, but he should not. You should not give a fish sprinkles.
Yeah. Don't feed fish human food, I think.
Do you know what I only found out recently, within like the past year and a bit? I forget when, probably the last year. I sent Amanda some flowers, and her cats had to go to the hospital because they ate them.
Oh.
I did not know. I had no idea. None.
Yeah, animals are very fragile, it turns out.
Yeah.
God, I didn't know that. I'm sorry. Anyway, so I sent her, I don't know what, like $100 of flowers, and she spent like $500 making sure her kittens didn't die because they were like a month old and her daughter was falling in love with them. It felt like the worst possible thing I could have done. Anyway, probably don't give chocolate to a fish.
That's the moral of the story. As he
that's the goldfish problem.
As he drops the chocolates on the floor, he notices scratches that seem to be related to moving the table. I love this scene because it felt like a puzzle game. It's like, oh, there's scratches on the floor. Slide the table over. Climb up on the table. Move the loose board. Find the cell phone behind the loose board. And he pulls out a flip phone and a key and has a bunch of missed calls from someone named Layla and one missed call from Duchamp, who is, as Guy alluded to earlier, a comics character known as Frenchie.
Great pronunciation, by the way.
Thank you.
I thought you were going to say Duchamp or
Duchamp.
Duchamp.
Duchamp, yeah. He's about to call Layla back when she, in fact, calls and seems very surprised to hear from him and wondering, like, what the hell happened to him. He's been gone, hasn't returned her calls for months, and finally says, "What's wrong with you, Mark?" And, of course, we heard the disembodied voice refer to Mark earlier, and Steven is very freaked out by that. She hangs up on him. And he suddenly starts hearing a voice telling him, calling his name and telling him he needs to stop as he wanders through his apartment. There are a lot of great shots in this episode with reflections not just in mirrors, but in like puddles and stuff too. Like I thought the scene where he walks away from the living statue.
Yeah, that was
great. Reflected in the water on the ground. So
because there's a secondary puddle that it looks like that is the reflection you're looking at. Like.
Yeah, there's some really
scenes almost broken up into three vertical zones, and one of the zones feels like the reflection until we pan up to see that the whole thing had been a reflection and a leaf falls in it.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of great cinematography and shots. Yeah,
I'm paused right now. I'm looking at it on when he's in the elevator clutching his cell phone. We see the front of his face, the back of his head, the front of his face again, the back. Like it is one of those infinite mirrors.
Yeah, all of which is also tricky to shoot.
It's crazy. Yeah,
you don't think about it.
I mean,
it.
They
it's
can CG
thing,
it, and they've got the budget, but yeah, it's tough.
The voice. He basically gets a scene where we see like the reflection in the mirror shaking its head and telling him he's going to get hurt and to stop looking. Everything starts to fall out of off the shelves in the apartment, and he runs out down the hall and into the elevator. At one floor, when it stops, he sees this, you know, the skeletal figure coming closer, and then it turns out to be an old lady who gives him a weird look, and he lies about trying to find his contact lens, and then realizes he's back on the fifth floor where he started. He turns around to find the skeletal figure staring at him, and then wakes up on a bus and sees the figure once again in the street, jumps off the bus, and spots Arthur Harrow, who is also on the bus, and realizes he's real. Goes to the museum, where he tries to convince the security guard not to let anybody in, which is a hilarious scene.
I love the whole museum thing. It reminds me, like, Donna especially reminded me of Doctor Who. I guess just because, like, British people hanging around an Egyptian museum is not Doctor Who. It's a sad indictment of imperialism. But the way she's called, like, the way she's treating him and, like, being larger than life and the way that nobody cares about him just felt like a fun, rompy kind of environment rather than, like, a serious research museum type thing.
Right. He works in the gift shop, right? Like, he's...
Right.
As he points out at one point, like, he's peddling sweets to kids that doesn't have anything to do with Egypt because it's not like Egyptians had candy. You know, he's upset about the actual content of the, like, learning. There's, in the museum.
They're missing two gods from their poster.
Right, they're missing gods on their poster. You
like
know.
The museum is a workplace comedy.
Right. Right.
Right, you know.
So as he goes in, he spots someone who was on the bus and follows them, only to run into Harrow again. He tries to get one of the other security guards to throw him out, but realizes that he is one of Harrow's minions. Harrow sort of gives him a little primer on Ammit, who is basically the god who got tired of waiting for people to do evil things, wanted to sort of deal with them before they could do those things. And mentions that she would have prevented all this terrible evil that happened in the world, but she was betrayed by other gods and even by her avatar.
Tom Cruise really messed her up. That was a reference to... Oh, my God, I can't even remember the name of the movie. Minority Report. Thank God.
Yeah.
Save that bad joke by not even being able to know the reference.
Harrow seems to have some idea what might be going on, because he says something about him having the voice in his head and tries to do the whole judgment thing on him, but the scales do not balance. And so that's where we get our sort of "there's chaos in you" remark. He runs away and Harrow lets him go, and then we cut to the museum shutting down for the night. Steven's leaving and hears a dog howling and starts going into the museum to look for it. There's another reflection shot where he moves and his reflection stays where it is. We get sort of a monster attack in the museum, which is fun because the creature is never really seen in focus, only ever seen in shadows and reflections for the most part.
Did it remind you guys of Aliens a bit? The way it moved and jumped on walls and was always...
A little bit
chaotically framed. Like, it's not like we ever see this thing, right?
It's got a jackal.
No, and that's what I like. Yeah. I like that you don't really ever see it. Like, they don't do a sort of typical Marvel, here comes the monster. Right.
Well, there's
shot,
a great shot of it reflected in one of the display cases where he can see it. Like, he is looking at it, and we get
it. You only get, like, you know, side glimpses, indirect,
or really
looks
quick
at it.
Cuts, right?
Or like, quick, yes. Yeah.
But it starts...
Is it affecting the environment now that I think about it? Like, is it knocking stuff over, or is it just...
He is the only one who knocks something over in that scene.
Yeah.
He knocks over a vase at one point and catches it.
Oh, yeah, he catches it.
Yeah, my wife was, like, really glad. She's like, I'm glad that they didn't have some, like, have the monster wrecking everything in the museum, because I would have been really upset about all that, you know, those irreplaceable artifacts.
Well, yeah, for sure. But now I'm thinking, like,
did that thing exist?
Was it real?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Well, Harrow seems to believe it does, because he comes on the PA and basically says, give up the scarab and you won't be torn apart. Steven throws his bag to distract it and runs and hides in the bathroom. And then we get finally a conversation between him and Mark, who is also Oscar Isaac, but with an American accent, telling him that he needs to give him control and stop fighting him so that he can save them from this monster. Steven relents as we see hieroglyphs on the wall and the costume starts to begin to form around him. The creature bursts down the door and, like, jumps on him. And then we get, somebody pointed out, a great sort of the entire expectations of this get flipped as we get like shots of stuff getting thrown out of the bathroom and then the creature trying to escape.
I love it. Just the way that like a creature, like a sad puppy clawing at the floor trying to escape something. It's like, oh my God, this is not going well.
Cut to the to Moon Knight beating the crap out of this creature, then turning around and we get a nice sort of reveal of the full costume like before it cut to black. So a lot in this episode. I thought it was super fun. I love Oscar Isaac. I mean, we talked him up a bunch, but this is a tough role. Like, there's a lot going on with this character, and we've discussed in the past in sort of our anticipation of this show the challenges that have to be dealt with in terms of dealing with mental illness and his condition, which is dissociative identity disorder. I thought that they, you know, while they play elements of it for laughs, it's not mean-spirited. Like, it's not targeting that as the funny thing. It's like, it's because it's terrifying in its humor at times, right? Like, he keeps blacking out and losing control.
I think the key thing to that is we are with him the whole time, and we are in his head, and we are confused, and we feel his stress and his bewilderment.
Right.
By doing so, we're not being like, wow, that guy's bananas, which is not a medical term, but it's a it's a way that they could have gone with this show, right? It's just show him being quote-unquote crazy. But what they're doing instead is sort of honoring the character, even this goofball portion of the character, in such a way that we're sympathetic to him, we're going along with him, and while clearly the memory losses are detrimental to his understanding and his connection to the world, they do not make him a bad person or worse in any way. We, in fact, we identify with him and we want him to figure out what the hell is going on.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
And it's, I think I like the way they portray him as a nice guy, really, even though he is sort of a loser. Kind of a loser. I mean, you know, he's not, I mean, he has reasons for not being successful, obviously. So that's fine. But like when he's with that, the, you know, talking to the gold guy, he brings him a sandwich. He reminds people to tip him when they get their picture taken with him. And then he tips him at the end when he leaves.
He gives him, he gives him like cookies or something. He gives him pralines, I think. Because he says another set of pralines for the man himself.
Okay.
Like, I mean, he's bringing him a treat.
But he brought him something. Yeah,
exactly. Like, we don't know if that statue guy views this dude as his friend or just a guy who shows up randomly to talk to him. We actually have no idea, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have a feeling that maybe he doesn't, like, you know, that Steven doesn't know him at all.
Right.
Steven just goes up and talks to him, and that Mark actually knows him. And the guy, maybe the guy knows the difference, and he's like, I'm not talking to him because he's Steven.
It raises a fascinating question, too, because we learn about all the things where there's like gaps in his memory, and some of them certainly seem to suggest that Mark has been pretending to be him, right? He asks the girl out on the date.
Right.
He is clearly not, like, even though he gets a lot of flack from Donna for being late, he's been missing for like 2 days, which means he either didn't go to work or Mark went to work pretending to be him. Like, there's a couple little weird gaps there where it's like we don't entirely understand.
Well, we don't know what the impetus is for the switch, right? Like, if it's stress or if it's something else, or like at some point he's got to get from Europe back home to London, so he has to kind of, like, the way I read it was that Mark James Bonded Steven's coworker and then didn't write a note to Steven to tell him that he had a date, kind of thing. Like, it.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
I think Mark was hoping to have more control and be able to go on that date.
Right.
You know, but whatever.
And
who knows? Who knows? Who knows what switches, I mean, what?
And Steven is clearly not, you know, not cognizant of Mark's existence up until this point. Whereas he
straps himself in and puts sand around
his
face.
But I mean,
sure,
he's not aware of there being another person. He's aware of perhaps his body, like,
blanking out and
wanting to do things. Yeah. But this seems to be his first time where, like, he is confused about the usage of the name Mark. He doesn't understand that there is another person involved here.
Is the tape on the door, like, one of the first things I remembered when, I don't know, it was like probably a James Bond movie, Dr. No or something, where he puts his, put some tape on the door in his hotel room.
It's a classic spy thing.
To see, right.
Yeah, I know it's a classic spy thing. I'm just trying to remember the first time I thought of it. But it's like, was the tape on the door to... The first time we saw it, was it to monitor if anybody had tried to come in?
No, I think it's for him.
It's for him. It's right, like,
to go out.
Because he puts sand on the floor around his bed.
He chains himself to the bed.
Yeah, he's clearly got all these things to, like, he's got multiple locks on the door, right? I thought all of that was to prevent him from leaving the apartment, essentially, or to at least be aware of it if he did.
Yeah, and I definitely think that...
No.
Well, the audiobooks and stuff that he was listening to seem to do that too, which is trying to keep. Honestly, this seems like it's going to just make you. I am sure during the course of reviewing the show, I'm going to screw up in somehow. Staying awake all the time does not feel particularly conducive to mental health.
It's not good. No,
I was about to say it would make you bananas, which. Maybe they're doing a better job than I am at this.
It's not healthy, we can say that.
It can't be healthy, right. And yet he's trying to do it because he's obviously completely terrified of what happens when he passes out.
Well, and there's an interesting, I wrote this phrase down because it jumped out at me, but like when he's trying to stay awake, the voice at one point says, you'll need 5 hours to become your natural self.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means, but it has left me intrigued.
I was kind of like, you should not be selling audiobooks that try to convince people to stay awake all the time. That cannot be. Well, that's not a healthy thing.
I also like, he's clearly.
That's what amphetamines are for. And that's, we don't like those. They're bad.
There's some very subtle stuff in here, too, suggesting, because we don't know how. What we don't get a lot of is the backstory here in terms of like how long has he been working here? Like, how long has he been having these episodes, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because we see, for example, there are some cues that have been a while where they talk about solving puzzles and he's just doing the Rubik's Cube, but like super fast, like flicking around with his hands. Like, all right, this is practice. This guy has been doing this for a while, right? He is clearly, it's not like a condition that has probably been bugging him for, you know, a couple weeks. It seems like something longer term, but we don't
really know. A mentally alert and keen and dexterous person.
Right, exactly. Yeah, mm-hmm. And he's reading all these books and doing research and like taking notes. And
even when he's, you know, he's on the back foot and he's completely terrified and he's being chased, he does a great job driving that truck.
Right, even though
he doesn't have a license and he does not drive it off the edge of the cliff, which I think is much more likely in that scenario. So he clearly has some sort of innate skill.
Well, and you can
throws the gun, which is a very like, I don't know. If he is from the UK, he's not going to think about shooting through the... It's like, he's just totally panicked. What do I do with a gun? I have no idea.
Like it's a hot potato. No, I mean, there's clearly...
Well, it's just not something... It's like not culturally a thing that he's ever been around, you know?
Right, so. Right. You can sort of tell that in like watching British shows.
Yeah.
Maybe it was Vigil. I don't know. It just seemed like there. I'm thinking of Beforeunders, which is a Norwegian show. But it's, you know, another place where they don't have handguns lying around like we do. And it's just like they seem really uncomfortable with these. The
probably,
cops,
probably,
you know,
probably the way.
Yeah, exactly. Like the characters it should be. Like they don't move around. Ah, man. If you've ever watched old X-Files, it is adorable that like. Police officers would often just, or FBI agents would walk around with their gun at hip level, like just pointing it with like their elbow to right, you know, like these days it's all like fancier and they've all got tactical training because whatever. But like, I get the same thing from like European shows, which is like these people are just not comfortable and nobody's training them. And it doesn't matter. It's not really the point of the story to go around this corner with a mag light and a gun in your hand at the same time. So, anyway,
One of the things I'm also like, you know, the backstory stuff that kind of interests me. Harrow recognizes him when they're in the village. He says he knows him and identifies him as a mercenary. Of course he's
but he doesn't know him by name. He knows him by, I don't know. I saw you on a list of baddies, kind of thing. Like he.
Or they've encountered each other. It's unclear, right? Like,
but everybody drops. Right. But he, I guess maybe that's part of his personality, though, right? Because he doesn't say, "Oh, Mark." Like, he doesn't address him as somebody that he's tangled with in person before so much as like, oh, you're a known.
I think he knows him by his reputation or something.
Or he's encountered him in another situation where he was not directly dealing with him, but like knew somebody who knew him or something. But he, you know, we
because he doesn't shoot him immediately, which I feel he could have gotten away with.
I don't think he, like,
he just
really
murdered
have a good
that
read.
Old woman. I guess he didn't murder her. That was
but we don't have a good read on Harrow. He doesn't, I mean, he is a villain, clearly, or like he, but he doesn't seem to believe that he's a villain, right? He has his own, like, he thinks he's looking for evil.
I did like his first attempt to talk him down, which was, I forget what it was, but it wasn't threatening. It was like, it was kind of threatening in the way he delivered it, but it wasn't, pointedly linguistically threatening.
He didn't say give it to me or I'll kill you. He said like,
no, it was like,
I suggest you hand it over or something like
that. Yeah, it was a very like, this is just give it to me and everything's gonna be okay sort of vibe to things. And even when that whole scene had some great physical comedy in it from Oscar Isaac, which is like, I mean, you're not gonna think he's a physical comedy guy, but when he's marching away with his arm behind him and his legs are getting lifted up really tall, like pantomiming walking away kind of thing while having the top half of his body
I know what you mean.
Backed and they just grab him. It's like, that is just some like a small bit of good physical comedy work that I just really enjoyed.
I mean, so Ethan Hawke as Arthur Harrow, you know, Ethan, what is there to say about Ethan Hawke? The man is a legend. I mean, he is.
He's amazing. I am shocked that he's, I'm shocked that both of them have been a Marvel thing. I can see Oscar Isaac a lot more because he seems a lot more fun.
And he's youngish.
I think Ethan Hawke isn't
like,
fun.
He's done Star Wars and, you know, he's done franchise work.
Yeah,
he's done X-Men.
Him and Pedro Pascal chumming around and being goofy. Like, Ethan Hawke is like, oh man, I just came off of a shoot in, I don't know where, Guatemala, where I play a snake. And it's like, yeah, I would believe that. I would believe that you just spent 8 months of your life pretending to be a snake. That's totally a possible thing. Yeah. But this is interesting. And it really works because he feels a little disconnected from the Marvel universe that we've seen, right? Like, this character is austere
and
dress.
I like how you don't get any clues about the Marvel universe in this episode.
Well,
right.
That is something we talked about in the preview of this, is like, this is the first thing they've done on Disney Plus that has no links at all to any character from the movies. Everything else has been like a follow-on, right? Like, we had Wanda and Vision, we had, you know, Sam and Bucky, we had Loki, we had Clint. All of these were like people who are side characters, you know, in the movies who didn't necessarily get like full feature time, but now we're gonna like flesh them out a bit. This is the first really like we're breaking in a new character, one that most people who have, you know, gotten caught up in the Marvel stuff don't even know about. I mean, even a lot of people who read Marvel comics probably don't know about Moon Knight. He's not a top tier character, right? Like,
I've read a lot of Marvel comics, and I don't know.
I don't think I've ever read a Moon Knight. And he's sometimes, but he very rarely interacts with other heroes.
He does on occasion, but yeah, he's a very
Much more rarely than, you know, because
they
love
when he
to
does,
do,
he's the weirdo. He
doesn't show up in like Secret Wars or, you know, I mean, he
doesn't pal around with the Avengers very often, right?
No,
like, he's not a joiner. He's not a team player. But he's
more Batman than Batman.
Yeah, right.
Batman, like Wolverine, is just on every team that'll have him.
But to your point, there isn't anything really in this first episode that even tips the hat. The only thing I saw that might be an Easter egg, somebody pointed out, was on the, when he's in the cupcake truck, the box in back of him seems to say, like, it has like script on it that says like Von D.
I did see that, but I
don't know what it is, but I don't know if it's actually a Doctor Doom reference, but if anything, it's like just a
I'm positive we see more of those boxes in later scenes. Like I said, I've only seen it once.
I tried to slow it down and I didn't get a great look at it, but somebody had a screenshot somewhere. It doesn't clearly say Von Doom or anything, but, you know, it's unclear. Like,
that could be Latveria.
It could be Latveria. Like, I was thinking that. Yeah. Like, there is a creepy castle and everything, but but there isn't really anything that
Yeah, I mean, but nothing on the face. I mean, no one mentions the blip or anything like that.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
I was going to sort of maybe save this for after the ratings, but I think it makes a lot more sense now. Previously, the Marvel shows have picked up with where we left the characters, right? Sure. We either know who the characters are, or like, you know, Vision and Wanda. The first episode did not have to introduce those characters to you. In fact, they assumed that you knew it and put them in a weird situation. I think Falcon and the Winter Soldier was like, hey, these two guys do military pew-pew stuff, so let's do that. This one is like, we don't know this person at all. And it felt, for the first time in a while, where Marvel has been just introducing a character cold. Like, Spidey didn't even do that.
Sure.
Spidey has Tony Stark showing up all the time, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is clearly the next sort of phase, for lack of a better word, of the MCU streaming shows, right? Because you've got this, we've got Ms. Marvel coming up, which is also a newish, you know, like a character that does not, it has some links to the MCU clearly, even from the trailer, but is not somebody that like people are familiar with. She-Hulk is coming up too. I mean, I know Mark Ruffalo shows up in that, so there are some links in to the existing MCU, but I agree. Moon Knight is definitely the one that feels the farthest out there, both in terms of not being as connected and also just tone and story wise. It's also something that is very different, I think, than what we've seen to date. And you're right. It almost, it's also playing with this idea of like the origin story, right? We're certainly not seeing it in order. We're not seeing, my name is Mark Spector, and this is how I became Moon Knight. You know,
We don't see how he gets.
I was bit by a radioactive moon.
Right. He's already Moon Knight.
Yeah,
but we're seeing it from Steven's perspective.
Right. And so,
and this is not a qualitative judgment. It's just like this is a different way of telling a story than we've previously seen on MCU TV.
Right. And it's what's interesting about watching this unfold, as I'm sure we will over the next several episodes, is like there's sort of multiple vectors in which you could go here, because like you want to solve the mystery of like, well, what's the deal with like the first 90% of this episode is what is the deal with Steven and Mark? Like what is going on in their lives? How are these two people connected, sharing this body, etc.? And then it's really only in that last shot that you're like, and there's this superhero in a white costume who seems to be connected with an Egyptian god, which is like a whole separate story to it almost, which I love.
And the god is hilariously human.
Yes.
In that he's like, what the hell is going on? Like, he's so frustrated by just events outside of his control. And he's a god. And that kind of makes it funny just by itself, right? Like, the way he's frustrated, he's getting stymied by some idiot that keeps possessing the body that he needs to do to kill people or do whatever the heck he actually wants to do.
Right. Like, what's the agenda of that, of the god? What's the, what is Mark up to? What's his connection with Layla? All this jungle.
Did those logs that fell down a mountain and killed people James Bond style, is that the act of a god, or is that just crazy happenstance?
Yeah, unclear. There's a lot of questions. I'm loving it. Like, I love the mystery aspect of it. It reminds me of some of the stuff I think that we really enjoyed in WandaVision and Loki, especially, of just being like, yeah, we're gonna like slowly unravel this as we go, but we're gonna drop you right down in the middle of this big world, and you're gonna have to sort of figure out what's going on.
Right.
But yeah, Loki had a little bit of this in that, like, the whole world was new to us, but we were with an old friend, effectively, right?
Right.
Or frenemy, whatever you want to describe him, but like a familiar character, and here we're just kind of dropped in the deep end.
Right.
Yeah. Where, you know what? I was going to say, where do you think it's going? And I kind of don't care, because there's no answer. There's no good answer to it, right?
I mean, I think...
Yeah, I don't have an idea. I mean,
I think at some point we'll get the explanation for how Mark ended up, you know, being... where Moon Knight came from, what his relationship with the god... I have not referred to him by name, but his name is Khonshu. We will find that out, I'm sure. And, like, how that relationship developed to the point where he is now. I'm sure we'll get the backstory on that. I'm curious to see how they develop his dissociative identity disorder and like how that did that. Yeah. Was that something already in play? Was it something that came about as a result of his interactions with a god? Like, there's a lot of questions there. And I think different ways to handle it, some of which might be more interesting than others, I suppose. But yeah.
Would you, I was going to say be satisfied, but I guess I'll ask you, John, first. Do you think that they would run an MCU show where it turned out that the superhero aspect was just imaginary and sort of all up in somebody's head?
I mean, I think they could if they thought that was a good story, sure. I don't think that's happening.
I don't think that's happening either.
I think there's enough evidence that things that, you know, he's actually doing things. Like when he blacks out and those guys are lying in the street bleeding. Something happened there. Yeah. I mean,
John, they all ran into each other. It was just a big accident.
Right, right. And it is a little weird about the dog. Like, did the dog thing actually destroy anything? Was the dog thing actually there? I'd have to go back and look again to be sure, honestly, but
gets broken and thrown out into the hall.
Yeah, like, I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that gets broken.
Okay, yeah,
I think it probably was, but I couldn't tell you off the top of my head right now. Yeah. I don't think that this is that's what they're doing.
Yeah, it's not like, what was it? Not Glass, the other one. Unbreakable, where at some point you think maybe he's imagining stuff, but he's not.
Yeah.
Dan, did you have... I asked John first because, I don't know, you have a disastrous way of just dissecting all of this crap. So what do you think?
I agree with John. I don't think that's what's happening in this case. And I agree that it's a story that they could tell if they felt like it served it. I don't know that that's a story they want to tell or that they're setting up to tell here, because I think that would, it opens some cans of worms that I don't think is the way that they want to handle this.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that they'd like to view Steven and Mark as, you know, well-developed characters who are, you know, have a you know, mental illness, right? Like, and to find a way to like portray that respectfully as somebody who also just happens to have become a superhero. And that is one reason that I think that I will be interested to see how they handle sort of, if they talk about the origin of his DID, if they, you know, delve into that at all. I think it's a subject that needs to be handled delicately. And I don't know, I'm kind of curious to see how they do it. Like, so I agree. I think this episode did a good job of that. It doesn't make it feel like everything is just a delusion being experienced by Steven. Like, that's what makes it so harrowing is that real stuff is happening to him and he doesn't understand why. And that's an interesting story.
I agree. I just think I thought maybe it was worth considering.
Sure. Before, yeah. I mean,
you know, like,
yeah.
It's a valid question.
Yeah. I tend to agree. I mean, you've already got a high degree of difficulty. If at the end of your six episodes, you turn out to do the end of Newhart, that's not,
there's
three listeners or readers that is like,
Suzanne Plachette still working.
Oh my God. She works for me every time I see her visage on screen. Love that woman.
I think that it's one of those things that like it was maybe clever, right? When you pulled that off, but like it's become a trope, so you can't easily do that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean do exactly that,
right. But it was all a dream, or it was all in your head, or stuff like that.
So the creature does appear to affect the environment, unless he walks back and like everything is normal. He knocks a door down and he pulls off the like the coverings on the lights as he skitters across the ceiling.
Okay.
And he also bashes that door in.
But, yeah.
Which, you know, could
yeah,
be.
Yeah, but Mark's going a little.
Could be fine when he wakes up.
Because we see it only from his perspective at that point. So,
Well,
rating?
Yeah, let's do a ritual. John, you want to go ahead?
Oh, it's a strong biff. It's fun and interesting and of course well acted by a very handsome man. So
that's how I describe this show.
Yeah, thanks.
I'm not gonna ask who he's referring to.
I know he didn't it's say not that. I'm stealing that honor. It's not you. I've seen you looking like you're about to steal a Russian submarine. Which, if you are, great, because we could.
Yeah, sure. With them. Yeah, no, yeah,
they don't need it. They don't need them anymore.
No, they definitely do not need those subs.
Give it to
Guy, you wanna?
Oh, this is a biff of Conchu. It's great. I loved it. I didn't know what to expect. I knew how much I liked Oscar Isaac. I'd also seen the X-Men movie, which was not fair to him at all. You know, I even really enjoy him in the Star Wars movies, where he gets very little to really do it anyway, and that's not his fault. He is an amazing actor, and he has done a great job here. I think the supporting cast is wonderful. I really, really enjoyed Donna, of all people. Just a bit of fun, swearing up a storm, and you know, but just calling everything bloody and like being generally antagonistic was fun. I like kind of the abstract nature of the bad guys, where they're going to judge you for future crimes. It seems like,
yeah,
interesting
stuff. You're going to do bad stuff, man. We got to put a stop to you now.
I mean, that woman went up to get judged. And she said she'd lived a good life the whole time, and our apparently bad guy character, and I'm pretty sure he's a bad guy, but, you know, our character said that he believes him, and maybe it's about stuff in the future, which we're not going to learn anything more about that woman, so I have to believe that that was all set up to understand it, like it's what you're going to do in the future that matters. When he tries to judge Steven, it's all mixed up, right? Because Steven's probably going to keep doing awesome stuff or being a good person. Mark? Not so much. Mark does not seem like a gentle kind of person. So it's interesting. I think they did a better job than I would have expected them to do. And I'm really, really looking forward to seeing where this goes.
Yeah,
like we've said, I've had some trepidation about how they're going to handle this kind of thing, but so far, so good. Came out of the gate strong, respectful, smart, and I just honestly, it's six, and I know we've said so often on the show that I want fewer episodes in a season. I kind of want seven now. You know what I mean? Like, I already want another. Like, just
don't do that.
Yeah.
Right. Well, it's such a dicey line to walk, because I did feel like, and the part of me is like, wow, one episode in, I already feel like, how do you tell this story in six episodes? But I think that's a good place to be, right? It's because, like, suggests to me what you always want out of these things is like a really tight, well-crafted story. And I feel like, you know, if you go in knowing we got to tell this story in six parts, then hopefully that's means you're being. You're being economical and lean with like the way that you're telling the story. And so one of the things I wanted to say I appreciate is I always struggle a little bit. You know, we all watch the trailers and stuff. I always worry that they'll just like, oh man, it's just like, the whole thing's going to be me like picking out scenes from the trailers and being like, yeah, I saw that. And certainly there's a lot in this first episode that was from those early trailers.
I was happy that they front-loaded all of the stuff.
That's exactly what I was going to say, which was so much of what we saw is in this episode. And I think that tends to be the case in a lot of movie trailers these days, is like, especially Marvel does a pretty good job of like highlighting stuff that's from, say, the first 15 minutes. So you know, like, the setup and where it's going without necessarily knowing every single beat that comes along the way. Mm-hmm. And I think they do a nice job of the setup here. And I like that it's disconcerting and weird. It's not, you know, totally outside of the tone of a Marvel movie, but it is definitely something that is not quite what we've seen to date, right? A lot of it shot at night in the dark. It's not as dark as the Batman, but it's, you know, it's still a lot of sort of dim shots and sort of, you know, nighttime vibes. You got that creepy scene in the elevator and all of that. It feels very different. And obviously it's a little, I think we're all expecting a little more intensity from some of it just based on the source material. I and I believe it's rated. Is it rated TVMA? I thought it might be.
Oh, I don't know.
I don't remember now, but I thought look. Because it, I had thought maybe because they just rolled
really
out.
I don't
the,
need to see much more gore than what we got.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting it needs
boobs,
that. I'm just
like,
curious.
Whatever.
Curious yeah. to know because, you know, Marvel has been very diligent about keeping. There was the whole, you know, this is sort of yeah. a side note, but that whole thing this past week where they got like it was like, oh, they're censoring those episodes of Falcon and Winter Soldier that had blood or violence in it, and it turned out that was done in error, or at least so they said,
supposedly.
I mean,
well,
I believe
here's
it.
The thing: it was the error that this is definitely we're in sweep now. Not really.
Well, I guess I hadn't given a thing, yeah.
right? But just briefly, done in error can mean a lot of things. A
Yeah.
We uploaded the wrong asset, or we were wrong.
We
and
did
we
it,
are
and
changing.
Then we realized we shouldn't have.
Right? Yeah, those are both in error. So
yeah.
Anyway, long story short, I will agree with the Biff. Solid Biff. I enjoy this. I haven't read a ton of Moon Knight, but I have read a few runs, and I especially recent ones. I think I want to say I can't remember who did the recent ones that I read, but. Some of them are they're really trippy and weird, and I yeah. enjoy that because it goes a little bit beyond what your standard you know superhero narrative often seems to be. So that is a fun thing to sort of delve into, and I think as Marvel enters its you know 50, it's close to its 15th year of doing MCU movies, you need to stretch yourself a bit, right?
Yeah.
You need to try some different stuff, and I think this is a great opportunity. And Oscar Isaac, you could not find somebody better to anchor this than Oscar Isaac. The man is just, he's great. He's yeah. just a fantastic presence. He's versatile. He's funny. He's, as I think we pointed out, charming even in his sad sackiness, which is a hard thing yeah. to pull off. So I'm very intrigued to see where the next several of these go.
Yeah. Makes me kind of wish Pedro Pascal had a Marvel role today.
Hey, you know what?
Hey,
don't count him
yeah,
out.
Right?
I mean,
yeah.
yeah. And so the only reason I'm connecting them to is that they both seem to be really best friends. And I really enjoy Pedro Pascal, but he plays a lot of heavies at times, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, even The Mandalorian or what's his name? Din Djarin? Yep. Dan? Something like that? Yeah. Kind of a one-note guy, intentionally so, and he does a great job at it. But his performance in the Wonder Woman 1984 movie was probably one of my favorite parts.
Oh,
of it.
He's got great comic chops too, and
yeah,
again, he just
yeah,
doesn't
exactly.
get a lot of chance to. I feel yeah. like I throw him out there with somebody like Timothy Olyphant, who he played opposite against,
yeah.
of course, The Mandalorian, and that
hilarious.
He can really do a very serious role, but he's got the ability to do humor and comedy, as does Oscar.
Well,
Isaac.
It looks like he's in that Nick Cage movie. Which looks
oh, that's
like
right.
Might,
yeah.
might be able
yeah.
to
yeah.
stretch yeah. those, you know, exercise those muscles a little bit.
Yeah. So,
yeah. yeah.
I would.
Some of the, honestly, some of the best performances are people that can do comedy and Breaking Bad. That is just stock full of comedians. I can't, you know, so many stuff. What's his name from Mad Men? John Hamm.
Mm-hmm.
Funny
oh,
guy.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, kind of annoyingly so. I mean,
I would
like
argue
Timothy Olyphant and like all of these incredibly yeah. handsome, funny people. Like,
I would argue John Hamm's comic abilities are even better than his dramatic
Probably.
Abilities. Like he's a solid
yeah.
dramatic
oh,
actor,
yeah.
but I think he is an extremely talented comedian. And
yeah.
I agree,
yeah.
he's just ridiculously handsome.
Right, right.
It's a dragon
yeah, yeah,
guy.
Like,
it's annoying.
He's very funny in Kimmy Schmidt.
Yes, he's great in
yeah.
that show. He's fantastic
totally
in that show. He's
yeah.
good in his Apple TV commercial. I mean...
Yeah,
he's
also
good.
Good
yeah.
in that.
Yeah, he's... Anyway.
Anyways, we've got well
Bob
Odenkirk
can hold down Better Call Saul, which is like, have you seen Mr. Show?
Yes, I have seen Mr. Show.
They're very different kinds of
very different
television. Yeah.
All right, do we have anything left to say about Moon Knight, or shall
Let's
we?
Do a very quick sweep.
Okay, we'll do a quick... We'll, of course, be back to talk about episode 2 of Moon Knight next week.
Do we have to?
Yes,
I'll,
we do.
I'll be here. You're welcome to join me.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
But for now, let's pop over to some superhero sweep really quick.
I don't have any topics other than you have seen the Batman.
I thought you were. I thought you had something prepped here. I was ready to go.
Yeah, no, just the Batman.
To take care of it, and then.
And I guess,
hey guys, how's it going?
Well, the Batman, pretty cool. I don't want to get into it because John hasn't seen it.
I still haven't seen it.
Yeah, Dan, myself, Tony. Who else is on that list? Dan.
I'm sorry. On what list are we talking about?
The list of stuff that we're doing for the Batman for the Incomparable.
Oh, the people. I believe Cicero Holmes.
Oh yeah, he's great.
And was Lisa on that with us?
Lisa Schmeiser. Yeah. I knew it was one of our
There will be a panel
from our sibling.
Yeah, there will be a panel on the Batman. There's your sneak preview of who's going to be on it, and that's a great group of people. I really look forward to talking about it.
Yeah, me too. Everybody. Really, it's really going to be fun. I'm so glad not to have to deal with Malt.
Congratulations.
But we will do it here too.
I'm sure we will. It's coming out in like 2 weeks or something on HBO Max. So honestly, everyone will have
a chance.
We've
got thoughts, right, Dan?
Right.
So after I saw it first, and then now do you know why I was like, hey, I've got some thoughts about this and I kind of want to talk to you guys about it?
Oh, yeah. It is. It is, just to say sort of generally, I had low expectations. We spent a whole bunch of time talking about the trailer and everything out of that and like what we like about Batman, what we don't like about Batman adaptations, all of that. And I did not have high hopes for this based on what we talked about. And it was much better than my expectation. Like, I actually enjoyed it quite a bit.
And it got interesting.
And was surprised at how well it sort of did some stuff. It's not a perfect movie. There are some flaws. I would pick some nits.
I don't want to ruin it for Malt by saying nice things about it. But I do want to say, I'm kind of curious about what you have to say.
Yeah. So I think it'll be an interesting conversation.
I hate it already.
Okay. Great.
Yeah, good.
Excellent. We need a foil. We need every podcast superhero.
I'm pretty sure I can foil myself if I start thinking about that movie too. Who cares? Whatever. We're going to save that for another one. Just readers, we're on it. It's not. Do you know what we won't talk about? Whatever that stupid vampire movie is. I forgot. Honestly, Malt and I, well, and Dan, we're texting today and we were like, is Morbius
even out? We don't even know.
And we basically made a pact.
We don't want to know.
Yeah, we made a pact to just not know. We don't want to know.
I heard the reviews have been pretty brutal. So
I just don't care. Yeah.
It doesn't. Sony does not have a great track record. I mean, I know some people liked aspects of Venom. I didn't. I still haven't seen it.
I have not either. It just doesn't.
It doesn't appeal to me.
A movie that's just the villain does not appeal to me. I never saw the Joker either.
They're struggling too because I think they don't have a large number of heroes in their stable. Although that's not entirely true. There are plenty of other Spider people.
Yeah, there are plenty. I mean, they could do anyway.
Spider-Gwen.
I wish they didn't have Spider-Woman. I wish Marvel had the property. I wish. I don't want Disney to buy Sony. Because Disney already owns enough,
I've got serious.
I wish they would just throw $9 billion at Sony and say, give us back our Spider-Man.
I want all the pictures of Spider-Man.
I want to make all the pictures of Spider-Man.
I want all of that.
Anything else to talk about?
Besides
ending this show on a high note of crapping on a movie that people worked really hard on.
I will say, I was just thinking forward to MCU stuff. So Moon Knight ends on the 4th of May. And I believe, does Doctor Strange come out? I think the day after that, I want to say.
It's what? Early May. Yeah, I think that's right. I think it does come out on the 5th.
Yeah, so I will bet.
I was thinking Spider-Man No Way Home was a Doctor Strange movie just because they're all in infinite crisis on infinite Earths right now with the way everything connects.
Yeah, so that comes out on May 6th, which makes me think, I wonder if we'll see another trailer basically between now and then. I wouldn't bet against it. So I'm curious because I feel like that even having watched that trailer, I still have very little idea of what that movie's about. So I'm kind of I'm intrigued to see where that goes.
There's a multiverse. You see,
the thing with
there's madness,
the multiverse and wackiness with like the No Way Home stuff too, is that it's so nonlinear and everything happens in weird, random ways.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad that they gave us a sort of front-loaded preview for this show. But, you know, when realities are getting rewritten, it's really, you can't really stick this stuff together from a preview. But I still don't want to see that many scenes, so I'm going to avoid it anyway. Well, that's a lie. I'm going to watch it, but only, only like 5 to 8 times.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That sounds reasonable. All right, we should wrap up for this week. As I said, we'll be back next week to discuss episode 2 of Moon Knight. But as always, I would like to thank everybody for listening. You can hit us up at biff@theincomparable.com if you want to send us a letter to talk about your love of Moon Knight, your questions about Moon Knight, your, I don't know, your fears about Moon Knight, whatever you got, or at BiffCast on Twitter. And we really appreciate everybody reading the transcripts and showing up for the old Biff book club. That's right, the old Biff book club. I dragged it out, like it. Dusted some mothballs off. It still exists.
Good. Yeah. Hell yeah, it does.
And of course, I would like to thank my compatriots for being here. John Moltz, always a pleasure.
Sorry about the cupcake.
Guy English, thank you for being here.
Check out this deep thing I've been saving for the whole app. Later, Gators.
He says, which, laters, Gators.
Which, by the way, there are 2 gator heads on the
and
on the tattoo. And Hamlet is and a gator
his,
head.
And on his staff, yeah. too. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, there's something going on.
That was deep, guy. Damn
and
it.
I know. I kept it in my pocket this whole thing.
Nice.
Well done.
I'm getting good at doing this.
Finally, like almost 200 episodes in.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. Like 8 years later.
Well, thank you everybody out there for sticking with us. Hope you're doing well. We'll see you next week.